Well, tonight we continue our series on the existence of God. And as we've said, we're using Stephen Charnock's Existence and Attributes of God as the primary source, along with Herman Bavinck and some other sources as well, but primarily following Charnock's argument. When you think of the existence of God, he started with Psalm 14:1, that the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And not an absolute atheist, but one who rejects God's sovereignty over him, and that God would be a judge over him at the end of life. And it's important for us to strengthen our faith, to think about God existing and as the creator of all things. I remember Dr. Eric Alexander, his sermon on Isaiah 40, and he said, the saints in the Old Testament fed their faith on the doctrine of creation. And we could do much as well to gain from that in our day. Part of this as well in this study is defending the faith, of having reasons to defend our Christian faith against unbelievers, to give reasons for the hope that is within us, 1 Peter 3:15. So it's to strengthen our own faith as well as to help us defend our faith against the naysayers. Stephen Charnock, as we've said, he lays out four main arguments for the existence of God. And the first one was production. Production. And tonight we're starting harmony, and then we'll move into ends and then preservation. And it's under this broad heading of it's foolish to deny what all creatures manifest. Another way of saying it is evidence for the existence of God from created things. And the first main evidence is the production of all things. And that's what we looked at last few times we met. But another evidence for the existence of God from created things is pondering their harmony from different angles, which is what Charnock does. As with the production of the world, so the harmony of all the parts declare the being and wisdom of God. If you know the common phrase I use for wisdom, then you know that I typically say it's knowing what is fitting. What is fitting. And this is where the harmony of all the parts of created things declare not just the being of God, but the wisdom of God, because he has fit all the parts together harmoniously. In a grand scale of the universe itself, that we have a cosmos, not chaos. It's orderly. It's a universe. Unity and diversity, but there's unity. It's not just chaotic diversity. No, it's a universe. So another way of saying that is we have a cosmos, which signifies order. It's not chaos. The American Heritage Dictionary defines harmony as this: an orderly or pleasing combination of elements in a whole. An orderly or pleasing combination of elements in a whole. The example they give is the order and harmony of the universe. Another definition that's given for harmony in the American Heritage Dictionary is this: a relationship in which various components exist together without destroying one another. Without destroying one another. And we'll get to that when Charnock looks at the harmony of qualities that are contrary, such as heat and cold, dryness and wetness, that neither destroy one another. Okay? So that's one way, as well as looking at harmony, is a relationship in which various components exist together without destroying one another. But an orderly or pleasing combination of elements in a whole. In a whole. And this is where everything is a system. We speak of the solar system. We speak in astronomy. We start studying the stars and galaxies. We speak of a solar system. It's an orderly, harmonious system. And we'll have more to say on that. In fact, I brought some books. I was thinking today on my other job, I was thinking, you know, it'd be nice if I brought some concrete examples, rather than just in general referring to it. So I went down to my library in my basement and I dug out my old human anatomy and physiology textbook. At the beginning of the textbook, it lays out all of the systems in the human body. There's 11 technically, but if you look at the reproductive system and split it up into the male reproductive system and study that separately from the female reproductive system, then you're studying 12 systems. Okay? Just in the human body, there are systems where they all have organs and components and parts, but they're all harmonious. Each part has a function or purpose, as well as the system itself has a system purpose. That when all the parts are there and they're working, you have a system that also performs a function and a purpose. But each part in the system as well has a purpose. Which is why I said at one point a couple times ago we met that harmony and ends are a part of the teleological argument for God. The teleological argument for God, where you're dealing with purpose, design, ends. And that's where harmony and the next one we get into, ends, are related. We can distinguish all of these. That's why he talked about preservation within production. You can distinguish the four: production, harmony, ends, and preservation, but never separate them. Okay? But here you just think of the human body, and there's the integumentary system with the skin, for instance, hair, nails. You got the skeleton system with all the bones, the muscular system, the lymphatic system with our immunity and the functions it performs, the respiratory system with breathing, the digestive system. We have the nervous system with the brain and spinal cord. We have the endocrine system with various glands, the cardiovascular system with the heart and blood vessels, the urinary system with the kidney and the bladder, and then the reproductive system, both male and female. Here's a poster that goes along with it. Physiological interactions. Okay, the idea is they're all interacting. Okay, so we have these each 11 systems, and they're all interacting systems within the human body for a whole body. When you think about the harmony of who we are as human beings, that we are fearfully and wonderfully made, and how wise God was when he knit all our parts together and various parts to form various systems that are unique in themselves, and to combine all the systems together so that we can sit here right now, alive, functioning. I was thinking as well about other systems. So you have the solar system with galaxies and the stars, the planets. You think of the human body and all of the systems we have. And many of the systems are irreducibly complex systems. And I've talked about this before, but this book was published in 1996, Dr. Michael Behe. Some of it's technical. He tried to write sections for the layman, just the regular person, and some of it more for a scientist. So some of it's technical. Some of it is not. But Darwin, the point is Darwin's black box. When Darwin had his evolutionary theory, he had no idea what was occurring at the cellular level, at the biochemical level of life. It was a black box to him. He had no clue. But we now, in our day, have a great understanding of what's taking place at the cellular level and at the biochemical level. But his base illustration of an irreducibly complex system is a mousetrap. Is a mousetrap. And in a mousetrap, an old-fashioned mousetrap, right, where it has a platform, there's a catch, there's a hammer, there's a spring, there's a holding bar. You remove one part, just one part, you remove it, it won't work. The system won't work. It will not catch a mouse if you remove one part. It all has to be there at once for it to function as a system. And that's where you think of the 11 systems in your human body, and they have various parts. Essentially, they're all irreducibly complex systems. Essentially, they're all the parts have to be there for it to function properly. There's no way it could have gradually evolved, adding one piece upon another piece upon another piece. No way. And he goes into it at the biochemical level, and I've mentioned blood clotting in the past. And there's a whole bunch of different processes that take place when you cut yourself and you start bleeding. And various things kick into gear. It's the blood clotting process. There's a system there that starts the clotting to stop the bleeding so you don't bleed to death. And then that clotting process has to stop or you'll clot to death and blood won't flow anymore in your body. And then it heals over. But that's a whole process of hundreds of different things. Active enzymes and different processes. In the human, we have what's called eukaryotic cells. Stephen Charnock died in 1680. In the 17th century, he died 1680, that's the 17th century. They had crude microscopes in the 1600s, the 17th century. They had crude microscopes that could see the nucleus of a eukaryotic cell. Okay? There's two main types of cell, but we, who are multi-celled organisms, we have eukaryotic cells. Our cells have nucleuses, and as well, there's extra membranes around them, not to get into all the details of it. But they could see even the nucleus of a eukaryotic cell with crude microscopes in his day. There's all sorts of different things within a cell. The human body is composed of hundreds of trillions of cells. Hundreds of trillions of cells. There's all sorts of different things within a cell. Just to list some, there's a nucleus, there's mitochondria. If I read a little bit about mitochondria for you, the typical cell contains about 2,000, just one cell. We have hundreds of trillions of cells. Just one has roughly 2,000 mitochondria. And they occupy typically 20% of a cell's volume. Each of the little compartments contains machinery necessary to capture the energy of foodstuffs we eat, and store it in a chemically stable yet readily available form. The mitochondrial mechanisms that do this are quite complex. Systems everywhere. The system uses a flow of acid to power its machines, which shuttles electrons among a half dozen carriers require an exquisitely delicate interaction between many components. And each cell has roughly 2,000 of these things. There's all sorts of different things within a cell. There's nucleus, mitochondria, lysosomes, there's endoplasmic reticulums. The lysosomes are essentially bags of enzymes that degrade molecules that have outlived their usefulness. They're kind of going around vacuuming things up in the cell. The endoplasmic reticulums, they're extensive, flattened, convoluted membrane system divided into two different components. They have numerous ribosomes attached to them, cellular machinery that synthesize proteins. There's as well a Golgi apparatus attached to them that's involved with protein modification. There's cytoskeleton, it's called, within the cell itself, certain cell structure. There's microtubules. They have different various functions. There's microfilaments that also have different functions, almost like a muscle. They're made of a certain protein, actin. There's intermediate filaments. And think, almost all eukaryotic cells contain all of those organelles I just listed. And we have hundreds of trillions of cells, and every of them have all of these various organs in them, performing all sorts of different functions, and they have systems. At the cellular level, it takes a very special microscope to see it all. Plants, as well, they have additional organelles. The chloroplast, studied a lot of them in forestry. The chloroplasts have the chlorophyll in it, which is able to absorb sun energy. So it's able to take energy from the sun and fix that energy into plant material. When you eat food, the energy that's stored there is measured in calories, right? Calories is energy. Where did that come from? Well, ultimately it came from the sun. We're going to get to this, okay? Of how the sun is related to the earth to the sun, and all these interactions and interdependencies of the harmony of all things. But during photosynthesis, the plants have the chloroplasts, which have chlorophyll, which then they're able to catch light, and they're able to take energy from the sun and fix it in the plant material that we later can eat, and it's released for energy. The harmony of all things is incredible. One more example, just a brief example. I'll read a little bit. This is a book by Stephen Meyer. This was published in 2009, called The Signature in the Cell, DNA and the Evidence for Intelligent Design. He said this, beginning in the 1990s, scientists began to do what's called minimal complexity experiments, in which they tried to reduce cellular function to its simplest form. Take the function of cells and take it to its simplest form. Since then, biologists have been able to make increasingly informed estimates of the minimum number of proteins and genes that a hypothetical protocell might have needed to survive. Most basic, simplest cell. The simplest extant cell, Mycoplasma genitalium, a tiny bacterium that inhabits the human urinary tract, that's the simplest extract cell, okay? And it inhabits the human urinary tract. It requires only 482 proteins to perform its necessary functions. This is the simplest cell that we have. And it requires 482 proteins to perform its necessary functions and 562,000 bases of DNA. Deoxyribonucleic acid, there's nucleotide bases on the DNA. Nucleotide bases, they code for amino acids that are the building blocks of proteins. Just in that simplest extant cell, requires 482 proteins to perform its necessary functions and 562,000 bases of DNA, just under 1,200 base pairs per gene to assemble those proteins. In minimal complexity experiments, scientists attempt to locate unnecessary genes or proteins in such simple life forms, and they go about different ways of doing that. I won't get into too much on that. He gives an example here. Of course, building a functioning cell, at least one that in some way resembles the cells that we actually observe today, would have required more than just the genetic information which directs protein synthesis. It would have also required, at the very least, a suite of pre-existing proteins and RNA, ribonucleic acid molecules, polymerases, certain enzymes and active proteins, transfer RNAs, ribosomal RNAs, synthetases ribosomal proteins, for example, to process and express the information stored in DNA. In fact, there are over 100 specific proteins involved in a simple bacterial translation system. Roughly 20 more are involved in transcription and over 30 in DNA replication. Cells have to split, they have to copy themselves and divide. Your skin cells die, right? You get dry skin, you have to put lotion on your skin. Well, they're replicating the DNA, and then they're copying it and making a new cell, right? All of this is taking place, all this machinery and system work is taking place all the time in the human body. Consider this with combinations. For every combination of amino acids that produces a functional protein, there exists a vast number of other possible combinations that do not. And as the length of the required protein grows, the number of possible amino acid sequence combinations of that length grows exponentially, so that the odds of finding a functional sequence, that is a working protein, diminishes precipitously. You say, what's the mathematical odds of finding a functional sequence, that is a working protein? Right? We talked about chance. Chance is the mathematical probability of something taking place. Doesn't do anything, just what's the mathematical probability of something taking place? Obviously, the longer the protein, the odds to get a working protein out of random combinations diminishes precipitously. To see this, consider the following. Whereas there are four ways to combine the letters A and B to make a two-letter combination, AB, BA, AA, BB, there are eight ways to make a three-letter combination, AA, AAB, ABB, ABA, BAA, BBA, BAB, BBB. Eight ways to make a three-letter combination, and 16 ways to make four-letter combinations, and so on. So eight ways for a three-letter combination, 16 ways for a four-letter combination. So you think, well, it just exponentially keeps growing. So the number of combinations grows geometrically. And this growth becomes more pronounced when the set of letters is larger. For protein chains, there are 20 to the second power, or 400, ways to make a two amino acid combination. Since each position would be any one of 20 different alphabetical characters. Similarly, there are 20 to the third, or 8,000, ways to make a three amino acid sequence, and 20 to the fourth power, 160,000 ways to make a sequence for amino acids, and so on. As the number of possible combinations rises, the odds of finding a correct sequence diminishes correspondingly. But most functional proteins are made of hundreds of amino acids. Therefore, even a relatively short protein of, say, 150 amino acids represents one sequence among an astronomical large number of other possible combinations, approximately 10 to the 195th power for a small protein. The complexity of God's systems at the cellular level, at the human body level, with all of the systems we have, with all of their various parts, each functioning as a system and functioning together in the human body, the harmony with all the cells, hundreds of trillions of cells in the human body, each with all of those various organelles inside each and every cell, doing their own systems. When I was in forestry at the University of Minnesota, in the early 90s, across the federal government, they started all of their environmental management with a systems-based management. Ecosystems, for instance, in forestry. That was something new in the early 90s. That we have ecosystems. That you go out and study any type of forest and you have to look at it all together. Because you move one part, and it changes the whole thing. So you've got a particular type of soils, astronomical number of different types of bacteria in the soils. But it's all connected, too, with what plants are growing there, right? What organisms are there? What's the climate and the weather, the hydrology, the sunlight, periodic of fire, wildlife? I mean, you start bringing it all together, and it's all a system now. And then they're categorizing everything in various systems And that's how your approach was to manage it for certain goals. Nature, in other words, functions as systems. The earth itself is a system. Go on the top of Mount Everest and see how well you do breathing. You're not going to last long. You and I need a certain amount of oxygen. We need a certain amount of air pressure. You know that native inhabitants high up in the Himalayas, they have very larger lungs than we do because there's not much air pressure. But they won't live at the top of Mount Everest. You have to have oxygen provided. But we need certain food, we need certain water, we need certain sunlight. You got a whole system, all interconnected with the solar system as well, with Earth, with the temperature a certain way, water and everything else. Okay. That's my lead in. It's kind of long, but without acknowledging God, as I put on the board, the atheist can give no account of harmony. Of the new atheists that exist today, Richard Dawkins is one of them. He speaks of the God delusion. To him, there's merely the appearance of design. To him, there is merely the appearance of design. Dr. Michael Behe, he says this about design. Okay, we're in harmony. We're in harmony, right? Dr. Michael Behe says this, page 193 of his book, Darwin's Black Box. What is design? Design is simply the purposeful arrangement of parts. The purposeful arrangement of parts. What have I been describing in all of this? The purposeful arrangement of parts. All of the organelles in the cell. All of the various parts in every system of the human body. And all the each system is a part of the human body. Right? And all of the parts and the systems of an ecosystem. The parts of the solar system and how we're a part of the whole thing and interacting with it. All in harmony. That it's purposeful, intentional. There's design. An intelligent mind is behind it all. Design is simply the purposeful arrangement of parts. And many will say, this is really more than production. Out of design, the teleological argument, harmony and ends, out of design is the greatest argument for God. Many will say that. You don't get irreducibly complex systems slowly adding one part and another part and another part. They all have to be there, and hundreds of them together all at once to have a system function. Right? Take the radiator out of your car and tell me how long it'll go. It's a system. It needs every part, right, in the engine. That's the whole point of it. The only way to explain it is a designer who put it all there at once. Okay? Every system, in other words, where I said before, quoting Charnock, thinking of production, where every creature, every blade of grass, as R.C. Sproul says, whispers in your ear, there's a creator. The point here with harmony is every system whispers in your ear, there's a creator. I have a creator. I have a creator. Every system does. Especially the irreducibly complex systems. But Richard Dawkins, he says, oh, no. It's just the appearance. It's an illusion. He's the one that's deluded. Professing to be wise, he became a fool. I got a quote from Charnock here. As the cause is known by the effects, so the wisdom of the cause is known by the elegancy of the work, the proportion of the parts to one another. The elegancy of the work, the proportion of the parts all one to another. How everything fits together, it's designed. I put this as well. Anyone who has studied physics knows that our world and universe is mathematical. I'm one who loves biology. Okay? That was applied forest biology. Silviculture was my specialty in undergrad. I love biology. Not as much chemistry, not as much physics. But I was in physics with engineers. I was thinking of becoming an engineer out of high school. and did not like all the math with it. I got into calculus, but that's not for me. I do know that. Okay? We have different gifts and calling in life, right? But anyone who's studied physics knows that our world and universe is mathematical. It's all math. You want to start studying the laws of gravity? It's all math. Energy? It's all math. E equals MC squared. It's all math. Inertia? Centrifugal force? There's mathematical formulas for everything in the physical world. To say it can be explained with math formulas means there is harmony and there is order and that the universe is rational. Math is symbolic logic. 1 + 1 = 2, whether you're sitting here or on Mars. Charnock says this, here's a quote, "No work of art springs up of its own accord. The world is framed by an excellent art and therefore made by some skillful artist," unquote. As rational creatures, our minds are not confined to our physical senses. We see, or taste, or touch, or hear, or smell. We're not confined just to those things, but we have a mind to think, and we reason from our experiences to contemplate who created and arranged the harmony of all creatures. God's eternal power and Godhead are clearly seen, being understood with our minds, by the things that have been made. Science. By studying the things that have been made, our minds reason from them, the harmony and order we see, back to the artist, the designer. Charnock has three main headings under harmony. So the first one there is in the linking contrary qualities together. In the linking contrary qualities together. The second one will be in the subserviency of one to another. In the subserviency of one to another. And then the third will be the admirable variety and diversity of things in the world. So the first one, in the harmony, the linking contrary qualities together. And here he's thinking of, think of in your mind of dryness and moisture, as well as hot and cold. Things that are contrary, that are linked together. They're contrary qualities. Rather than completely destroying one or the other, remember the definition I gave, the second definition that's in the Dictionary of Harmony, a relationship in which various components exist together without destroying one another. And here you have contrary qualities that exist together but don't destroy one another. Charnock says that they are, quote, linked one within another in every body upon the earth and rendering mutual offices for the benefit of that body wherein they are seated. And I put, just think of a couple examples of sweating or of ecosystems where you think of dryness and wetness, hot and cold, to have appropriate seasons in ecosystems to have certain vegetation sprout and grow. Sweating. Think of sweating. We've had some hot weather, right? It's important that we keep drinking fluids, a lot of water, right? Don't want to get dehydrated. And yet what's very important is evaporation. When you sweat, what happens when you sweat? It takes energy to turn water from a liquid to a gas. It takes energy to do that. So when water is on your skin and it evaporates, it goes from a liquid to a gas, it takes energy, so it cools you. It cools you. Wetness and dryness working together there, contrary qualities, helping to cool you on a hot day. Otherwise, you'd have a heat stroke if you didn't sweat. How can they who are opposites work together for one common goal or purpose? How can heat and cold or dryness and wetness work together for a common goal or purpose? Only by one Lord who is supreme over all. I go to Job 38, 4. Job 38, 4, the Lord speaking, answering Job. Hear now the words of God. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Now go down to 19 to 33. Verses 19 to 33. And I want you to think of opposites, contrary qualities that Charnock's talking about. Verses 19 to 33. Where is the way to the dwelling of light? And darkness, where is its place? Contrary qualities. Lightness and darkness. That you may take it to its territory, that you may know the path to its home. Do you know it because you were born then, or because the number of your days is great? Have you entered the treasury of snow, or have you seen the treasury of hail, coldness, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? By what way is light diffused, or the east wind scattered over the earth? Sometimes it's calm, sometimes it's windy. Who has divided a channel for the overflowing water, or a path for the thunderbolt, to cause it to rain on a land where there is no one, a wilderness in which there is no man, to satisfy the desolate waste, where there's wetness and dryness, and in one area, clouds form over the Mediterranean, wetness, and are able to take clouds and transport it hundreds of miles and have rain come down on dry land and cause to spring forth the growth of tender grass. Has the rain a father? Or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb comes the ice, coldness again, and the frost of heaven, who gives it birth? Waters harden like stone, and the surface of the deep is frozen. Can you bind the cluster of Pleiades, or loose the belt of Orion? Can you bring out Maseroth, constellations in its season? Or can you guide the great bear with its cubs, with the migration, right? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you set their dominion over the earth? That's like in Ecclesiastes, to everything there's a season, contrary qualities. Psalm 103:19, God establishes throne in the heavens, his kingdom or sovereignty rules over all. Think of Romans 8:28, he works all things together for good to those who love him and are called according to his purpose, even the contrary things in this world. He'll work the coldness for your good. He'll work the heat for your good. He'll work the wetness for your good. He'll work the dryness for your good. Even the snow and the hail. He works all things after the counsel of his will. God is a God of order, not of confusion, and therefore he created a cosmos. There's order and structure in Genesis 1, laying out the 6 days of creation. The harmony and order we see in creation is not an illusion. It's real. The second main point that he has in this section, and we're just going to look at part of it, is in the subserviency of one to another. In the subserviency of one to another. Now, subserviency was a term. I was curious about this. So Charnock's, this was published posthumously, His Existence and Attributes of God, in 1682, 2 years after his death. This was a term that was a new term in the English language in the 17th century, where you're thinking about a subordinate place or function, a subordinate place or function. in the subserviency of one to another. And what he focuses in is the subserviency of heavenly bodies and how they are subordinate at times to the lower bodies like earth. And at other times, is the subserviency of the lower world, how it is subordinate as well, has its particular place and function for others, serving others, okay, in the harmony of things. Okay, we'll explain this. So up here, the general introduction here, in the subserviency of one to another, creatures are fitted to serve one another and destined for a particular purpose. This is under the broad heading of evidence for the existence of God from created things, and created things evidence the existence of God in their harmony as they are subordinate, serving one another. That's a part of the harmony. They have a place that God has put them to serve one another, each created entity. And it's what Charnock says, causing an exact correspondency of all the parts with one another. This is where you get the idea of a system. That they're subservient one to another in that system. So just think of the respiratory system, for instance. You have lung, trachea, larynx, pharynx, nasal cavity, bronchus, all sorts of different parts that have their serving a particular purpose within the system. They have an exact correspondency of all the parts with one another. We speak of the solar system and the gravitational forces between the planets and stars. We speak of ecosystems on planet Earth. Each cell is a system. Human body has 11 different systems. This is what Charnock says, quote, one thing is fitted for another. The eye is fitted for the sun, and the sun is fitted for the eye. Several sorts of food are fitted for several creatures, and those creatures are fitted with organs for the partaking of that food, unquote. How can cows be out here eating grass and hay and other things like horses? God gave them stomachs, right? To digest all that organic matter. We don't have that, right? You and I aren't going to do well. We go out here and start gnawing on the green grass that Pastor Ron and Kumo, we're not going to do well. But God has given them organs to be able to eat certain things. So he says, think of your human eyes. So in our solar system, our eyes are actually fitted for the sun, and the sun is fitted for the eyes to see things through the light that the sun gives. And there are unique things within the eyes for seeing what the sun provides in the light spectrum. I'm colorblind. I lack a couple things in my eyes. So I don't see certain things from the sun that you do. But our eyes are fitted for the sun, and the sun is fitted for the eyes. In the broad electromagnetic radiation from the sun, long wave and short wave radiation in the color spectrum, there's things, though, that we don't see, but there is much that we do see. I mean, think of that a minute, that here we are on Earth orbiting around the sun, and we have eyes that can see because of the unique things that the sun sends us. Why is it this way? It's because God has designed it that way. An exact correspondency of the parts one with another. So he he looks at, we're going to look at here, the subserviency of heavenly bodies. And then we're going to move into the subserviency of the lower world. Then we'll move into all this subserviency of creatures centers in man. And this order or subserviency is regular and uniform. So these are subheadings. I put them as arrows rather than Roman numerals. But first, the subserviency of heavenly bodies. So he's thinking of moon, the stars, heavenly bodies, the solar system, okay? Charnock, quote, "The sun is for the good of the world as the heart of man is for the good of man," unquote. If the sun, put on the board here, if the sun were not exactly where it is, in other words, another way of saying it is if the earth was not in its orbit a certain distance from the sun, the earth would lack the beneficial influences of the sun. We're at just the right distance from the sun so that we're not too cold and we're not too hot. We're not too close, we'd be too hot, and we're not too far away, we'd be too cold. This is a part of the fine-tuning of the universe. There's at least 36 laws in the universe that are finely tuned. Stephen Meyer, I referred a little bit to Signature in the Cell. He wrote another book, Return of the God Hypothesis, just a few years ago. And in there, he mentions, scientists have discovered at least 36 laws in the universe that are finely tuned. You change them just a little, and we're talking a little, and life on Earth would be impossible. But one of them is the distance between the Earth and the sun. But he would call it the subserviency of the sun to the earth, in a sense. It performs a function for the earth. I mentioned to you, all plants, they have the chlorophyll in their chloroplasts, in their cells, that's able to absorb sunlight. And they're able to transfer the kinetic energy from the sun and fix it into plant material with carbon in photosynthesis. So you have carbon dioxide, right? You breathe out carbon dioxide, CO2. Whew. Carbon dioxide. Well, the plant, during photosynthesis with light energy from the sun, it takes in carbon dioxide, removes the carbon from the oxygen, fixes the carbon in the plant material with other elements, and releases oxygen. And we need oxygen to breathe. And we need the carbon from the plant to eat when it's a certain type of plant, like lettuce. But all of that because of the sun. We wouldn't have nothing to eat. Ultimately, the animals wouldn't either without the sun. Sir Isaac Newton, he died 1727. He could explain with the law of gravity the places and motions of the planets, but not how they got to those exact positions or orbits. Newton believed God created all things, and he was very clear on that. It's all throughout his belief in God, is all throughout his writings on physics, on the solar system. But he said, "I have no way to explain how the planets got to where they are." It's one thing to explain where they're at and the gravitational pull and forces based on the mass of each planet and how they're orbiting based on the draw and the gravitational attraction. But he had no way of saying how they got there. No atheist does today either. We have periods of darkness each day, right? There was evening, and there was morning. a second day. There was evening and there was morning, a third day. Periods of darkness each day allow us to see, quote, the work of God's fingers, the moon and the stars. Psalm 8:3. Turn to Psalm 8:3. Just to make note of that in your Bibles. Psalm 8:3. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained. So the subserviency of heavenly bodies, and when we have periods of darkness, there's a subordinate place and function. What's one of the functions and purposes of darkness at night? So that you and I would be able to gaze at the stars in our galaxy. Now just think, we did not know that there were more galaxies than our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. We didn't know there were more galaxies until Hubble looked through his telescope in the 1920s in Southern California. Then he had a powerful enough telescope to say that each looked like each light out there was actually billions of more stars in other galaxies. That's just 100 years ago. But it's the darkness that allows us to look at that and gaze upon God's work. All the stars. Isaiah 40, you know, it says, lift your eyes on high and see who has created these stars. Calls them out by name. Right? And this is for us again. We are rational creatures to study what we see and to reason from it to the great artist and the wisdom of how there's harmony in it all. It's a solar system. You know, we don't do it in our day, but you know, back in Charnock's day, they could, out on the Atlantic Ocean, they could know their direction and where they were going by looking at the stars, right? It's a solar system. There's order. Think of this as well. The atmosphere between heaven and earth. Now, these are things he's making in 1680 that he's observing and thinking about. The atmosphere between heaven and earth is, quote, a channel for the overflowing water. Job 38:25. We read that. God says, who has divided a channel for the overflowing water? God put an atmosphere here. A real fascinating atmosphere. Scientists put them in layers. The troposphere goes up about 10, 12 miles, the first layer. That's what we breathe. We're in the troposphere, layer of the atmosphere. Temperatures get colder the higher you go in altitude. Then you get into the stratosphere, and temperatures actually get warmer the higher you go in the stratosphere because of ozone, O3, oxygen, O3, that absorbs light energy from the sun. All of the weather takes place in the troposphere, this bottom layer. It's where all the weather takes place. The clouds, it's a channel for the clouds, for the overflowing water, to satisfy what? The desolate waste, the dry ground, to move it from the Mediterranean in hundreds of miles and then to drop it in rain on a dry land. And he causes forth what? The growth of tender grass. Right? Job 38, verse 27 that we read. This is something where he's thinking of heavenly bodies, the atmosphere. And how that is serving us, the earth, and dry land and causing tender grass after the rain. So the sun itself serves earth, serves our eyes, serves earth. Think of photosynthesis with plants. The place of the planets orbiting around the sun in our solar system. There's periods of darkness as well. Where the earth is rotating, right? So we've got daily darkness to be able to gaze upon these stars and ponder the glory of God. The atmosphere is a channel of water and weather. Did chance do all this? He asked that question. 1680. Of course not. I mean, this is God to Job. Who's done this? Did chance do it? God asked Job, has the rain a father? Or who has begotten the drops of dew? Job 38:28. Who can number the clouds or pour out the bottles of heaven? Like right now, it's raining out. Job 38:37-38. I'll end with this tonight. Go to Psalm 19. We've referred to this before. I want to read it again. Thinking of harmony now, okay? Thinking of harmony, all the systems that I've talked about tonight. Psalm 19, verses 1 through 6. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them He has set a tabernacle for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoices like a strong man to run its race. Its rising is from one end of heaven. Now this is speaking in human terms. It does not mean there's an error in the Bible. You listen to the evening news. I have taken meteorology and climatology in college at the University of Minnesota. Even in the textbooks. What do they say? The sun rises and the sun sets. They tell you on the evening news, the sun rose today at such and such time and it sets at such and such time. They know full well our solar system is heliocentric, not geocentric. We've had the Copernicus revolution. We understand it, right? The Ptolemaic system's been overturned. That governed 1,000 years, that we thought the earth was the center of the system. No, we understand the sun is stationary and the earth is orbiting and rotating on its axis. But it looks to the human eyes if the sun rises and the sun sets. So the weatherman or woman on the nightly news says, the sun rises, it rose at this time today and it sets. You're describing it from a human perspective. That's all this is. Doesn't mean there's an error in the Bible. Its rising is from one end of heaven and its circuit to the other end, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. Day to day brings forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. I put, can you hear and understand the harmonious orchestra of created things? Can you hear and understand the orchestra of created things? That's what he's talking about partly in this. Not just their production, but their harmony. Do you hear the harmony of systems? When I think of harmony in my mind with music, one of the ones I go back to is Rocky, the original Rocky. And he's, if you remember the scene in there in the original Rocky, and he's walking along the street corner, and guys are out singing at the street corner. Harmony, a cappella. But really, the greatest in Western civilization is a symphony orchestra. There are four sections to an orchestra, consisting of woodwinds, the flutes, the oboes, etc., the brass, the horns, the trumpets, the percussion, kettle drums, and the strings. Right? Violins, cellos, etc. All of the various parts in harmony. In harmony. We have this in creation with systems. And every part fitting appropriately. An orderly or pleasing combination of elements in a whole. I didn't even go to the subatomic level. with an atom, with a proton, a neutron, and electrons balancing around it in a beautiful harmony. Systems everywhere, subatomic level, atomic level, cellular level, in our bodies with our 11 systems, in ecosystems, in the solar system, and in how everything relates with subordinate places and functions, even with the sun to Earth in various things, and the atmosphere to Earth. It's all interrelated. Are you hearing the symphony? God is speaking to you every day. We live in His theater. Lord willing, we'll pick this up next time we meet.